This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. We've all got our own internet rabbit holes.
Oh, Mr. Rabbit, wait!
Places on the web where we find ourselves wandering for hours.
Goodbye!
Starting a couple of years ago, Google's Ngram viewer became one of mine. You know how Google has digitized millions of books published over the last five centuries? Well, with their Ngram app, you can look up any word or phrase to instantly graph how frequently it was used during any period of time. For instance, I hate the way these days more and more nouns are being turned into verbs.
Juice? You want me to juice?
Such as, how will that impact you? So I made an Ngram to track impacting and discovered that it started taking off, no surprise, in the anything goes 1970s. Geek and nerd started proliferating around 1980.
Nerd!
But with Ngram, I discovered that geek was slower to take off and then, around 2000, overtook nerd.
I prefer the term film geek.
In other words, I regularly and totally geek out on Ngram. The app was invented by a pair of young mathematicians, Jean-Baptiste Michel and Erez Lieberman Aden. They told some of the origin story in a TEDx talk.
Everyone knows that a picture is worth a thousand words. But we at Harvard were wondering if this was really true.
It started in 2005 in Harvard's giant old main library. Michelle and Aden had been poring over books for more than a year for a linguistics project. Aden says that one day they noticed a book they were using in the library showed up on the internet.
And we thought that that was very strange because no one had taken this book out of the library for decades.
It was when Google was just ramping up its digital online library of every book ever published. Michelle and Aden saw an opportunity. If a computer could scan all the books for their research, they could save months or years of time. And who knows what they might find? Voila, Ngram.
It is a way for anybody to see how frequently any word or short phrase was used year by year for the last 200 years in our culture.
They launched it in 2010, and like I said, it's addictive. For instance, type in women and men, and you can pretty much see when the women's movement began. Women starts to spike in the 1960s, then surpasses men in the 80s, and falls behind again in 2005. In their TED talk, Aden explains how people use Ngrams for all kinds of research, like the guy who looked at how the word arg is spelled with various different numbers of A's.
This person was interested in the history of frustration. If you stub your toe, that's a 1A arg. If the planet Earth is annihilated by the Vogons to make room for an interstellar bypass, that's an 8A arg.
And because the Ngram shows changes in word frequency over time and in different languages, it can also unearth curious gaps.
If you take Marc Chagall or Pablo Picasso, Kandinsky, or virtually any intellectual, especially Jewish, especially artists, and you look for the trajectories of their names in books published in German, you will see huge dips, holes, really, literally, at about the time of the Nazi regime. So you can visually see the thumb of oppression pressing down the trajectories of these people.
Michelle and Aden decided that their new data-driven mapping of culture needed a scientific name. So they called it
culture omics, based on like genomics, you know, genetics plus omics becomes genomics.
Culture omics is just one way big data is making its way into traditionally less mathy fields. What's called digital humanities is a real academic growth industry right now. Daniel Edelstein's a French professor at Stanford, where he and a team created what he calls a kind of Facebook for the Enlightenment.
What I like to say is that our visualizations are great at giving you a very blurry picture of what might have been.
Their database consists of tens of thousands of letters written by intellectuals like Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Jonathan Swift during the 1700s, what was even then called the Republic of Letters. That correspondence was an important way new ideas could spread through Europe and around the world. Edelstein and his team have created maps that visualize how the letters flowed across countries and continents. He says there were some surprises. Voltaire is known for being influenced by his English contemporaries. But the maps that Edelstein and his team made showed something different.
Where are the letters to England? There's such a myth around Voltaire as having transmitted English thoughts about politics, about philosophy, about science into France, and there was just this gaping hole on the map of his correspondence.
Edelstein says this finding has led to a research project that will try to explain the hole. In the end, he says that working with code and data is not what he expected to be doing as a professor of 18th century French culture. Same goes for lots of scholars. Not just Stanford, but Northwestern, Arizona State, Georgia Tech, the University of Nebraska, all have digital humanities labs now. Erez Lieberman-Aden and Jean-Baptiste Michel say that technology can open up academic research to the independently curious, people like me, like you. But Michel says it's still important that bona fide experts are the ones interpreting the research.
I think it's inevitable that a tool like that will generate a large number of discussions that are actually irrelevant or wrong, just flat out wrong. But at the same time, I think it's also good that a tool that's at the leading edge of science can generate so much enthusiasm in the general public.
And Aden says that putting the engram in the hands of the public also means some less consequential but still interesting linguistic questions get answered.
One, you know, little example that comes to mind is, for instance, Dunkin' Donuts.
Time to make the donuts.
They spell donut D-O-N-U-T. But there's another alternate spelling of donut, D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T.
You mean the correct spelling of donut?
Yes. Yes, exactly. The correct spelling of donut for those of us who are donut strict constructionists. Anyway, so that's a basic question. When did people start spelling it D-O-N-U-T? And, you know, you might have a whole bunch of ideas. I mean, for instance, Teddy Roosevelt suggested a whole bunch of spelling standardizations that, among other things, would have changed D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T to D-O-N-U-T in order to simplify the English language. But many people responded exactly as you did and said, well, but that's completely incorrect and you just, you know, can't make force everyone to spell things wrong. And in fact, it didn't stick.
That was in 1906. No spike in the graph for D-O-N-U-T. Where you do see a spike is around 1950, the same year as an ambitious bakery opened in Boston.
Well, it seems like that's roughly contemporaneous with the creation of Dunkin' Donuts. So it's really this powerful international brand that led to a common alternate spelling for this particular pastry.
Which I guess is why Cronuts has no U-G-H in it.
If I want to answer to the question, I just type it in the Google. Yeah. The information age could lead me to my chicken noodles.
Erez Lieberman-Aden and Jean-Baptiste Michel say that harnessing the words we've used is one of the greatest untapped resources of academic research. The two of them have a book coming out later this year about what they call this revolution in data. It's called Uncharted: Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. Meanwhile, we've got a big data challenge for you all. Using Google's Ngram Viewer, search a word, a phrase, a name, or whatever combination of words or phrases or names you want. Send us your single best discovery, the most surprising or provocative or otherwise fascinating nugget you unearth, and we might call you to be on the air. Your deadline is Thursday, August 15th. You can get started right now at studio360.org.
Yeah. 100% publishing. Big data.
And a special thanks to Manish Agrawala, our scientific advisor on this segment.